From the dusty fields of Bondiqui, to the blood-stained battlefields of the Sahel, to the storm-lit streets of Ouagadougou, Ibrahim Traoré rose not for power, but for people. Trained by hardship, forged by betrayal, sharpened by fire, he stood when empires conspired. He endured when brothers turned to traitors. He fought and won, not with fear but with hope. This is not just the story of a revolution. It is the story of a dream, a nation reborn under the roar of a lion, who dared to believe that tomorrow could belong to the people. If you haven't already, make sure to follow us and tap the notification bell. We drop new content every day. Stay tuned so you never miss a story. Chapter 1: Roots of the Warrior. The Sahel sun was unforgiving, even in the earliest hours of the morning. Its rays spilled across the cracked red earth of Bondiqui, a modest town tucked away in the western heartlands of Burkina Faso. Here, among the low mud brick homes and whispering fields of millet, a boy named Ibrahim Traoré was born. Not into privilege, but into the rich soil of a people who understood hardship, dignity, and survival. His father, a quiet man of principle, worked the land with hands hardened by years of sun and struggle. His mother, a woman of warmth and fierce intelligence, tended to the household, teaching her children not only how to live but how to dream. Though they owned little, their home overflowed with a wealth of values: humility, respect, courage, and an unwavering belief that a better future could be forged with one's own two hands. From a young age, Ibrahim absorbed these lessons like the parched ground drinks in the rare rains. His mother often told him stories by the hearth, tales of ancient African empires, of kings who rose from nothing to lead mighty peoples. Her voice, low and musical, painted pictures in the smoky twilight. "Strength, my son, is not in the fist alone. It is in the mind, the heart, and the will to stand when others fall." By the time he was 6, Ibrahim was already different. Other boys played in the dusty alleyways, chasing goats and wrestling for fun, but Ibrahim was often seen perched on a smooth rock outside their compound, squinting at the horizon. There was something searching in his gaze, a longing that seemed far too vast for such a small frame. School was a privilege in Bondiqui, and his parents, despite their limited means, insisted that Ibrahim and his siblings attend. The local schoolhouse was a battered structure with peeling walls and a single, tattered Burkinabe flag flapping stubbornly outside. Inside, the air was thick with chalk dust and hope. Ibrahim quickly distinguished himself, not the loudest nor the boldest, but the most relentless. When he didn't understand a concept, he stayed after class, pestering the weary teacher with questions until he grasped it fully. When bullies mocked the quieter children, Ibrahim, though slight in build, stood between them and danger, earning bruises but also admiration. It was at school that Ibrahim first learned about Thomas Sankara, the revolutionary captain who had once dared to dream of a sovereign, self-reliant Burkina Faso. The lessons stirred something deep within him, something that went beyond admiration. In Sankara's defiance, Ibrahim saw the contours of a life he wished to live. Not for riches, not for fame, but for the soul of his people. At home, his parents encouraged his curiosity. His father built a crude bookshelf from salvaged wood, where Ibrahim carefully arranged borrowed textbooks and aging history volumes. He read under the oil lamp until late into the night, his small fingers tracing maps of Africa, his mind racing with questions. Why are we still poor? Why do foreign powers dictate so much of our lives? Why can't we stand on our own? The answers were not simple, and no adult in Bondiqui could fully explain them. But the seeds were planted, seeds of doubt, of anger, and most of all, of a fierce, protective love for his homeland. When Ibrahim was around 9 years old, a terrible drought struck their region. The millet crops failed. Families went hungry. The government in the capital, far removed from the suffering of rural towns, offered little aid. Ibrahim witnessed neighbors burying children who had died of malnutrition, simple, senseless deaths that should have been prevented. It was here, in the cruelty of an indifferent system, that Ibrahim's childhood was burned away, leaving behind something harder, sharper. One evening, after helping his father bury the shriveled remains of their crops, Ibrahim sat alone outside. The air was dry as bone. Overhead, the stars blinked with ancient, indifferent light. And in the silence, he made a vow. "One day I will fight for us. I will not let this be all we are." He spoke it aloud, though no one was there to hear, save perhaps the spirits of the ancestors, who, it is said, listened to such promises in the night. By the time he reached adolescence, Ibrahim had acquired a reputation in Bondiqui. Not for boasting, nor for mischief, but for a kind of stubborn righteousness. He helped elders carry water from distant wells. He protected younger children from older bullies, sometimes at great personal cost. And whenever a traveling merchant or village elder spoke of the world beyond their dusty borders, of conflict, injustice, hope, and change, Ibrahim listened with the stillness of a lion readying to pounce. His dreams of a better Burkina Faso were no longer vague ideas. They were starting to form into something tangible, a desire for service, for discipline, for strength tempered by compassion. In 2006, as he approached the end of secondary school, Ibrahim faced a choice. He could remain in Bondakwe, like most of his peers, eking out a modest life on land that grew less forgiving each year. Or he could leave, seek education, training, and the means to turn his ideals into action. It was not an easy decision. His mother wept quietly the night he told them he would apply for the University of Ouagadougou, aiming to pursue geology, a science that could help unlock Burkina's buried wealth. But deep down, even she knew, Ibrahim's destiny was never going to be bound to the narrow furrows of their farm. He set out for the capital with a small cloth bag slung over one shoulder, a handful of coins tucked into his pocket, and a head full of dreams that burned hotter than the desert sun. In the city, life was harsh and indifferent. Ibrahim attended lectures during the day, took odd jobs by night, and slept in crowded, crumbling dormitories. He saw firsthand the rot that had seeped into every corner of national life: corruption, inequality, broken promises. The ideals of Sankara, once proudly taught in his village schoolhouse, seemed distant echoes here, replaced by cynicism and foreign exploitation. And yet Ibrahim did not falter. If anything, the city's cruelty only sharpened his resolve. It was during these grueling years that another idea began to take root in his mind. True change could not come from books alone. It had to be fought for, defended, earned. When news of growing insurgencies in the north broke, villages torched, children kidnapped, government forces outgunned, Ibrahim's path became clear. He would join the military, not to conquer, not to oppress, but to protect the people who could not protect themselves. To build a country that answered not to foreign masters, but to the children of its soil. He enlisted not long after graduation, signing his name with a steady hand. As he stood in line with other recruits, sweat trickling down his back, a single thought thundered through his mind like a drumbeat. This is only the beginning. Chapter 2, The Young Cadet. The morning Ibrahim Traoré arrived at the National Military Academy was brutal. Not because of the instructors, not because of the training yet to come, but because of what the academy represented. A crucible, a place where boys were stripped of weakness and men were forged out of fire and will. He stood among dozens of new cadets, their faces taut with fear and excitement, uniforms stiff and itching under the unforgiving Sahel sun. The courtyard smelled of dust, leather, and nervous sweat. A stern colonel, his medals gleaming against his khaki tunic, barked the first orders of the day. "Look to your left. Look to your right. By the end of this year, only half of you will still be here." Ibrahim did as instructed. To his left stood a wiry boy, twitching with nerves. To his right, a broad-shouldered youth trying to look braver than he felt. Ibrahim's own heart hammered against his ribs, but outwardly he stood calm, straight-backed, as he had taught himself since childhood. He was not there for glory. He was there for Burkina Faso. The first weeks were designed to break them. Endless drills under the blazing sun. Forced marches carrying packs heavier than their own bodies. Crawling through mud pits laced with barbed wire, their elbows and knees bleeding raw. Sleep deprivation that turned days into a blur of shouted commands and aching muscles. Some cadets cracked early. One night, Ibrahim watched silently as a boy from the southern provinces fled into the darkness, discarding his boots and rifle in the dirt. They never spoke of him again, but Ibrahim endured, not because he was the strongest nor the fastest, but because inside him burned a stubborn, immovable fire. Every blister, every bruise, every sleepless night only deepened his commitment. In the rare quiet moments, a few minutes before dawn, or after lights out when snores filled the barracks, Ibrahim would lie awake, staring at the cracked ceiling, replaying the faces of those he had left behind. His mother's proud, tearful eyes. The hungry children of Bondakwe. The fields choked by drought and neglect. They were counting on him. Even if they didn't know it yet, the academic courses were no less grueling. Strategy, geopolitics, military ethics, engineering, survival skills, all crammed into 18-hour days. Classes were conducted in French, the colonial language still lingering over Burkina Faso's institutions like a ghost. Ibrahim hated that, not the language itself, but what it represented. the persistent fingerprints of powers that had plundered their land and warped their destiny. He applied himself with relentless focus. While others collapsed onto their bunks after dinner, Ibrahim could often be found crouched under the flickering light of a cracked lamp, poring over maps and field manuals until his vision blurred. He wasn't the smartest cadet. He wasn't the most naturally gifted. But no one could match his endurance. His instructors noticed. One day during a tactical simulation, when other cadets panicked under a simulated ambush, it was Ibrahim who calmly organized a defense, secured the perimeter, and extracted the wounded, all within 5 minutes. After the exercise, the commandant summoned him to his office. It was a sparse room, a single desk, two chairs, a battered portrait of Thomas Sankara hanging slightly askew on the wall. The old soldier studied Ibrahim for a long moment before speaking. "You don't flinch," the commandant said at last, his voice a low rumble. "Do you know why that matters?" Ibrahim hesitated. "Because a soldier must not show fear?" he offered carefully. The commandant shook his head. "No, Cadet Traore. Every man feels fear, even the bravest. What matters is that you choose, deliberately, to keep moving anyway." He leaned forward, his eyes sharp and appraising. "One day, others will look to you when the bullets fly. Make sure you are the kind of man they can believe in." The months rolled into years. Ibrahim grew leaner, stronger, and quieter. He learned to fire every weapon in the Burkinabe arsenal with precision. He mastered survival techniques for desert, jungle, and mountain warfare. He absorbed lessons on insurgency, counterterrorism, and urban combat, preparing for a future he sensed would be bloodier than anything his instructors dared to predict. He also learned humility. During one brutal exercise, he made a costly miscalculation that left half his team dead and his unit failing the mission. Rather than make excuses, Ibrahim stood before the tribunal, shoulders squared, and took full responsibility. That night, his peers, instead of mocking him, quietly began to treat him with a new kind of respect. In the crucible of the academy, Ibrahim forged not just strength, but trust. And among those who trained alongside him, a small circle began to form, soldiers who would, years later, become the backbone of his revolution. Yet even as he excelled, Ibrahim never forgot why he had come. During weekend leaves, while other cadets sought the fleeting distractions of Ouagadougou's markets and dance halls, Ibrahim would often visit the dusty, overlooked neighborhoods. He would sit with street vendors, elders, struggling students, listening, always listening. He heard their stories of families broken by jihadist raids, of farms abandoned to desertification, of young men forced to choose between starvation and joining armed gangs. The more he listened, the more the truth sharpened inside him like a blade. Burkina Faso was bleeding out, and those in power were either too corrupt or too cowardly to stop it. Graduation day finally arrived under a heavy gray sky. Rows of cadets stood stiff-backed in the rain, their new insignias gleaming on their shoulders. Families crowded under umbrellas, cheering and weeping. Ibrahim spotted his parents among them, his mother wrapped in her finest, carefully mended dress, his father standing proud, tears cutting clean tracks through the dust on his cheeks. When Ibrahim's name was called, he marched forward with steady, measured steps, his boots splashing in the puddles. He accepted his commission, second lieutenant, with a salute so sharp it seemed to crack the very air. He was no longer just a boy from Bondiqui. He was a soldier of Burkina Faso, a protector, a servant of the people. Yet as he stood at attention, the rain soaking into his uniform, Ibrahim understood something that many of his peers did not. The real battles, the ones that mattered, were still ahead, and they would not be fought on parade grounds or in textbooks. They would be fought in blood, sweat, and tears, for the soul of a nation gasping for its second birth. Chapter 3, In the Line of Fire. The orders came down with a cold efficiency that belied the chaos waiting beyond the horizon. Deploy to the Northern Front. Counterinsurgency operations. Rules of engagement fluid. Ibrahim Traore, newly minted lieutenant, sat in the back of a battered military truck as it rattled and jolted over the crumbling dirt roads that led north, into the scorched, bleeding heart of Burkina Faso's forgotten war. The heat was a living thing, pressing down from above and radiating up from the earth. The air reeked of diesel, sweat, and the faint iron tang of distant blood. Around him, his platoon, some just boys barely old enough to shave, shifted nervously, checking weapons, adjusting gear, muttering prayers under their breath. No one needed to explain what they were heading into. Northern Burkina Faso had become a graveyard of villages and ideals. Islamist militants, a shifting hydra of Al-Qaeda affiliates, Islamic State offshoots, and local warlords, had taken root across the Sahel, exploiting poverty, corruption, and neglect. They struck without warning, melting into the bush after massacres, leaving only ash and grieving mothers behind. The government in Ouagadougou issued optimistic press releases. The reality on the ground was much uglier. This was not a war of uniforms. It was a war of shadows, and Ibrahim was about to step into it. The first patrol seemed almost routine. They rolled through dusty hamlets, stopping to distribute food and medicine where they could. Children ran out to greet them, wide-eyed and barefoot, their laughter shrill and thin. Old men with calloused hands offered wary greetings. Women peeked from doorways, some flashing smiles, others veiling their fear behind guarded eyes. At each stop, Ibrahim dismounted first, hands empty and visible, his body language clear. "I am here to protect you. I am one of you." But trust in these lands was a rare and fragile thing. One evening, as dusk bled across the sky, Ibrahim's unit bivouacked near a small village perched on the edge of a dried-up riverbed. The villagers warned of strange men seen near the bush, men who spoke of holy war and demanded allegiance. Ibrahim listened carefully, his instincts prickling. He doubled the watch that night. It saved their lives. Just before dawn, the first shot rang out, a flat crack that tore the fragile silence apart. Then came the screaming. Militants swarmed from the treeline, faces masked, rifles flashing in the half-light. Mortars thudded into the ground, spewing dirt and shrapnel. Women and children scattered, shrieking. Ibrahim reacted without hesitation. "Form up. Return fire. Protect the civilians." His voice cut through the panic like a whip. He grabbed a young private, paralyzed by fear, and physically shoved him into cover behind a crumbling stone wall. He moved among his men like a conductor, directing fields of fire, calling for medics, shouting encouragement even as bullets snapped inches from his head. The firefight raged for what felt like hours. By the time the sun clawed over the horizon, the militants had retreated, leaving behind their dead, a smoldering village square, and the terrible silence of too many newly dug graves. Ibrahim knelt beside the body of one of his own, a boy named Issouf, barely 19, who had taken a bullet shielding a child. He bowed his head, tears mixing with the dust on his cheeks. There was no ceremony, no speeches, only the bitter, iron taste of reality. This was what they had signed up for, and it was only the beginning. Over the months that followed, Ibrahim's unit became known as the Phantoms of the North. They moved fast and struck hard, operating with discipline and cunning that belied their modest numbers. Ibrahim pioneered tactics that larger, slower government units failed to adapt. Night raids on militant camps, mobile patrols to prevent ambushes, intelligence gathering by building trust with local populations. He treated civilians not as potential threats, but as allies, spending hours drinking bitter tea with village elders, listening, learning. In return, the people began to whisper his name with a mixture of awe and hope. "Traoré, the officer who stood with us. The one who does not steal, who does not abuse, who fights and bleeds as we do." But with reputation came danger. Militant commanders began putting bounties on his head. Propaganda leaflets accused him of being a traitor to Islam, a servant of the infidel government. More than once, roadside bombs detonated under his convoys, hurling twisted metal and bodies into the air. Each time, Ibrahim survived. Not by luck, but by instinct. By preparation, by an almost supernatural ability to sense when death was near. One brutal night in mid-2021, Ibrahim's luck nearly ran out. They were escorting a convoy of refugees, women, children, wounded men, south toward safer territory. The column stretched too long, vulnerable. At sunset, the attack came. RPGs screamed out of the trees. Machine guns hammered the trucks. The world dissolved into smoke and fire and screams. Ibrahim was thrown from his vehicle, his body slamming into hard earth. Dazed, ears ringing, bleeding from a gash on his forehead, he crawled to his feet and rallied his men. "Hold the line," he roared, voice raw. "Protect the civilians. No one falls back." What followed was not a battle. It was a brawl, chaotic, desperate, close quarters. Ibrahim fought like a man possessed. He dragged wounded soldiers to cover, returned fire with grim precision, even wrestled a masked militant to the ground and disarmed him in the choking dust. By dawn, they had beaten the attackers back. But the cost was brutal. 3 soldiers dead, 7 wounded, 2 civilian children lost. Ibrahim stood among the wreckage, blood seeping into his boots, and made another silent vow. "I will not let their deaths be meaningless. I will fight until there is no breath left in me. That night, as the survivors huddled around a small fire, bandaging wounds and rationing supplies, an old man approached Ibrahim. His skin was like worn leather, his eyes clouded with age but sharp with something older, wisdom, perhaps, or prophecy. He knelt stiffly before Ibrahim and pressed a withered hand to the young officer's brow. "You carry the spirit of the lions," he whispered in a voice like rustling leaves. "You will not fall, but you will bleed many times before your work is done." Ibrahim said nothing. He simply bowed his head, accepting the old man's blessing and the burden that came with it. By the end of his northern deployment, Ibrahim was no longer just a soldier. He was a symbol, a warrior who fought not for power nor profit, but for the soul of a country that the world seemed eager to forget. But powers both inside and outside Burkina Faso had noticed him. And in dark rooms, in foreign embassies and gilded government halls, whispers began to grow louder. "Who is this Captain Traoré? And what might he become?" Chapter 4: Descent into Crisis. The battles in the north had left their scars. On bodies, on villages, and perhaps most profoundly, on Ibrahim Traoré's soul. But as he returned to the capital, the scars he found there were different, and somehow even more painful. They were scars carved not by insurgents, but by greed, cowardice, and corruption. He barely recognized Ouagadougou anymore. Where once there had been bustling markets and laughter echoing from open doorways, now there were silent queues outside crumbling banks. Gasoline was rationed. Hospitals overflowed with the wounded, while politicians gave speeches about resilience. And the promises, oh, how the promises flowed. Empty words cascading from marble podiums, while the blood of the North soaked unnoticed into the sand. Traoré knew war. He knew pain. But betrayal from within, tasted different. It tasted like ash. The new regime under Lieutenant Colonel Paul-Henri Sandaogo Damiba had promised salvation. In January 2022, Damiba led a coup against the sitting president, Roch Kabore, citing the government's catastrophic failure to contain jihadist violence. For a brief moment, the people of Burkina Faso had dared to hope. Soldiers danced in the streets. Civilians embraced in dusty courtyards, murmuring Sankarist slogans of revolution and rebirth. Ibrahim, watching from the barracks where he recuperated from his wounds, had felt a cautious stirring of belief. Maybe, he thought, just maybe this time, the sacrifice will mean something. But months passed, and the old rot remained. Instead of fighting for the people, Damiba and his inner circle fortified their own positions. Military contracts flowed to favored companies. Supplies meant for frontline troops vanished into the black market. Outposts in the north went weeks without ammunition or food. Soldiers whispered of betrayal in the ranks. Civilians muttered of conspiracies and backroom deals with foreign powers. Worst of all, Ibrahim saw villages he had once fought to save, villages where he had bled and mourned, fall back into the hands of insurgents. It was as if nothing had changed, as if the blood spilled had been for nothing. Inside the officer corps, frustration boiled over. Meetings that once discussed tactics now seethed with anger and disbelief. In one dimly lit briefing room, Ibrahim sat at the edge of a conference table as a senior commander droned on about strategic patience. He clenched his fists beneath the table, his nails biting into his palms, as maps littered with red XS piled higher by the week. When the meeting ended, a grizzled captain, a man who had fought alongside Ibrahim in the Sahel, leaned close and muttered, "They don't fight for the people anymore. They fight for contracts. For praise. For the cameras." He spat on the floor in disgust before walking away. Ibrahim stayed behind, staring at the blood-red lines on the map. Something inside him, something old, something sacred, began to shift. Beyond the military, the streets told their own story. Protests, once small and cautious, grew bolder. Women banged pots in public squares, demanding security. Students marched with handmade signs scrawled with demands for dignity. Farmers abandoned their fields to voice their fury. The walls of Ouagadougou bloomed with graffiti, some crude, others poetic. "We are the dust you tried to bury. No peace without justice. Traoré listens. You do not." It was subtle at first, a whisper among taxi drivers, a nod exchanged in shadowy markets. But the murmurs grew louder. "Traoré. Traoré is different. Traoré is one of us. Traoré remembers." Ibrahim tried to ignore it. He told himself he was a soldier, not a politician. A protector, not a ruler. But fate has a way of finding those who least seek it. One night, After a long patrol inspecting checkpoints on the city's fragile perimeter, Ibrahim returned to his barracks. He found a note tucked under his door. No signature. No fanfare. Just 10 words, scrawled hastily on a scrap of brown paper. "If you do not lead, we will all perish." He sat down heavily on the edge of his cot, turning the note over and over in his calloused hands. Outside, in the humid night, distant thunder grumbled across the savanna. Inside, Ibrahim Traoré wrestled with the burden that history had quietly laid at his feet. The breaking point came sooner than anyone expected. In September 2022, reports reached the capital. Gaskind, a key northern town, had fallen after a brutal militant siege. Dozens of soldiers and civilians slaughtered. Supplies looted. The government's promises exposed as hollow once again. The images flooded social media. Soldiers stripped naked and executed in the dust. Mothers wailing over lifeless children. Fighters hoisting black flags over abandoned military posts. The outrage was immediate. Soldiers rioted inside their own bases. Civilians demanded action in the streets. And somewhere deep inside the heart of the army, a decision was made. A decision that would echo not just through Burkina Faso, but across the entire Sahel. Ibrahim did not plot with schemers or careerists. He did not make secret alliances in gilded offices. Instead, he met quietly with a handful of trusted men, brothers forged in the blood and dust of the North. In abandoned classrooms, in darkened alleyways, in the backrooms of hollowed-out barracks, they spoke not of power but of survival, not of ambition but of duty. They knew the risks. If they failed, they would die as traitors. If they succeeded, they would inherit a shattered, bleeding nation. But there was no alternative. Not anymore. Burkina Faso was dying. Someone had to act. And so, in whispers and nods, in secret handshakes and silent oaths, the foundations of a new revolution were laid. As September drew to a close, Ibrahim stood atop a rooftop overlooking the city. Below him, Ouagadougou sprawled, a city of broken dreams and stubborn hope. The night air smelled of rain and burnt diesel. A dog barked somewhere far off. A child cried. And the stars, ancient and cold, watched silently. Ibrahim closed his eyes and prayed, not for victory nor for vengeance, but for the strength to endure what was coming. For the strength to serve without being consumed. For the strength to bleed, if necessary, so that others might live. When he opened his eyes, he was no longer just a soldier. He was a man walking into history's fire. Ready or not. Chapter 5, Thunder in Ouagadougou. The night of September 30th, 2022, was heavy with a peculiar kind of stillness. The kind that settles over a city just before it tears itself apart. In the barracks on the outskirts of Ouagadougou, Ibrahim Traoré tightened the straps of his flak jacket with slow, deliberate movements. His sidearm, polished but battered, hung heavy at his waist. Beside him, the men he trusted most loaded their rifles, their faces grim, their eyes reflecting the cold gleam of destiny. No speeches. No rallying cries. Only a shared, unspoken vow. Tonight, we take back our future. The plan was simple in theory, devastating in execution. Secure the national television station. Lock down key government buildings. Seize Damaba before he could flee or rally loyalists. Declare the birth of a new order before the sun rose. Timing was everything. Momentum was everything. Failure meant death, not just for them, but perhaps for every dream still beating in the hearts of their people. The convoy rumbled through the sleeping city like a metal serpent. A handful of armored vehicles, disguised at first as routine patrols, rolled quietly past darkened markets and shuttered shops. Soldiers in plain uniforms leaned from the windows, scanning alleys and rooftops for any sign of betrayal. The streets were eerily empty. A few dogs barked in the distance. A lone vendor packed up his cart, oblivious to the history unfolding mere blocks away. At each checkpoint, Traoré's men moved with quiet precision. A whispered password. A sharp nod. An officer placed discreetly on the ground, flex-cuffed and gagged before he could raise an alarm. In less than an hour, they had taken half the city's critical intersections without firing a shot. The night was theirs. For now. The television station was the first major target. A squat concrete relic of the 1980s, it loomed at the edge of a dusty avenue, its broadcast towers stabbing upward like skeletal fingers. Inside, a skeleton crew of technicians blinked in confusion as armed soldiers burst through the doors. There were no gunshots. No broken glass. Just swift, surgical domination. Within minutes, Traoré's forces controlled the airwaves. The old state broadcaster's logo shimmered on blank television screens across the country, awaiting a message. Awaiting him, the final phase was the most dangerous, confronting Damaba. Intelligence had placed him in the presidential palace, a heavily guarded complex ringed with fences, machine gun nests, and armored personnel carriers. Traoré knew there would be no way to take it quietly. He also knew he had no choice. At 3:17 a.m., the assault began. An explosion ripped through the main gates, a controlled blast, precisely measured, blowing a hole big enough for two armored trucks to roar through side by side. Gunfire cracked across the compound, shattering windows, chewing into stone walls. The defenders, caught off guard, scrambled to form a perimeter. For a few terrifying minutes, the palace grounds became a hellscape of smoke, tracer rounds, and shouting. Through the chaos, Traoré advanced on foot, weaving from cover to cover with deadly focus. He moved like a man possessed, issuing commands, flanking enemy positions, personally dragging two wounded comrades to safety under heavy fire. At the final barricade outside the main hall, he paused only briefly, panting, his uniform stained with dust and sweat. He could hear Damaba's loyalists shouting inside, barricading doors, overturning tables. He could also hear the distant, almost surreal hum of the city beyond, the city waiting, holding its breath. There was no time for doubt. With a sharp gesture, he led the charge. The hall erupted in close quarters combat. Gun butts slammed against skulls. Boots thudded into ribs. Shouts and curses ricocheted off marble walls. Traoré moved through it all with brutal grace, disarming, subduing, overwhelming. When it was done, Damaba was cornered in a side room, flanked by a handful of trembling loyalists. His face, once so composed, so imperious, was now slick with fear. He tried to reason, to bargain, to threaten. Ibrahim said nothing. He simply stepped forward, removed his helmet, and looked Damaba in the eyes, a gaze as steady and merciless as the Sahel sun itself. And Damaba understood. It was over. At 5:43 a.m., Ibrahim Traoré stood before a battered podium inside the seized television station. The cameras flickered to life. The microphones crackled with static. Across Burkina Faso, in mud-walled villages, in dusty markets, in crowded city apartments, the people leaned closer to their flickering screens. The image stabilized. There he was. Young. Unbowed. Alive with purpose. No suit. No military regalia dripping with meaningless medals. Just a simple uniform. A simple man. One of their own. His voice, when it came, was steady and low. Measured. Fellow citizens of Burkina Faso, he spoke of betrayal, of broken promises, of blood spilled on forgotten roads. He spoke of the duty owed to the martyrs of the North, to the hungry children of the South, to the elders who had waited too long for justice. He spoke not as a conqueror, but as a servant, a soldier, a son of the soil. Enough talk, he said, his voice rising, almost breaking. Now we act. Now we reclaim our dignity. Now we rebuild together. Across the country, a sound began to rise. At first, it was barely audible. The clatter of spoons against metal pots in cramped kitchens. The stomping of feet in the dust. The ululation of women in village squares. It grew and grew until it became a roar. A tidal wave of hope and rage and release that shook the very earth. Traoré! 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 The hero they had whispered about was no longer a whisper. He was real. He was here. And history, bloody battered but still alive, had found its next chapter. As dawn spilled gold and crimson across the battered skyline of Ouagadougou, Ibrahim Traoré stepped out into the morning air. Around him, soldiers, his soldiers, cheered, their faces lit with something rare and precious. Belief. He turned his face to the rising sun, eyes narrowing against the light. There would be battles ahead. Betrayals. Sacrifices he could not yet imagine. But for this moment, for this one heartbeat in time, the dream he had carried since he was a barefoot boy in Bandiqui burned bright and unstoppable. Burkina Faso was his to protect. And he would not fail her. Not while he drew breath. Chapter 6, New Dawn. For a few breathtaking days after the fall of Damaba, the streets of Ouagadougou shimmered with something rare and beautiful. Hope. It rippled through the markets, where vendors whispered Ibrahim Traoré's name with cautious smiles. It echoed down the narrow alleys of the poor neighborhoods, where children sang songs of victory between crumbling walls. It even flickered inside the solemn ministries of government, where officials once numb with cynicism now wondered if, perhaps, a better future might still be carved out of the wreckage. For the first time in living memory, the air itself seemed lighter. Burkina Faso had a leader who spoke plainly, walked humbly, and, most importantly, seemed to belong to the people, not above them. But hope is a fragile thing. and history does not yield its victories without demanding a heavy toll. From the very first morning of his rule, Ibrahim understood the impossible task he faced. The insurgency in the north raged stronger than ever, whole provinces slipping out of government control. Schools and hospitals lay abandoned, their skeletal remains testifying to years of corruption and neglect. The economy, already battered by war, teetered on the brink of collapse. And hovering above it all, the vultures of the international system. Foreign diplomats, corporations, mercenaries circled, offering help laden with invisible chains. Victory had given him the seat of power. Now came the harder part, delivering on the dreams that had carried him there. In one of his first acts as transitional president, Ibrahim gathered his closest advisors, a motley group of soldiers, civil society leaders, teachers, and doctors, in a dusty meeting hall repurposed as a temporary war room. There were no marble floors, no velvet chairs, only wooden benches, battered maps tacked to the walls, and the overwhelming smell of sweat and determination. Ibrahim stood before them in a simple, sweat-stained uniform. No gold braid, no general's stars. Still a captain, still a soldier. He looked each person in the eye before speaking, his voice low and steady. "The time for speeches is over. The time for action has begun. We are not here to rule. We are here to rebuild or die trying." No applause, no cheers, just solemn nods, and the quiet beginning of something extraordinary. His first moves shocked the nation. He abolished lavish government perks overnight. No more luxury vehicles, no more overseas junkets, no more obscene bonuses while children starved. He slashed ministerial salaries, including his own, refusing to raise his pay beyond the modest sum he had earned as a captain. He audited the bloated military supply chains, uncovering mountains of missing funds and stolen equipment. He ordered emergency shipments of food and medicine to the north, personally overseeing the convoys to ensure they reached their destinations. And when senior officials warned him that such reforms would anger important partners, he simply smiled grimly and said, "My partners are the people. Everyone else can wait." The response was electric. In the markets, vendors held up photographs of Traoré, not the polished portraits of past leaders, but grainy, worn pictures of him kneeling to speak with a wounded soldier or handing bread to a child. In the mosques and churches, prayers for the young captain rose alongside ancient hymns. In the battered north, where hope had been a dead thing for so long, whispers grew louder. "Traoré fights for us. He is not like the others. Maybe this time we are not forgotten." Yet with every step forward, new dangers emerged. The old elite, politicians, generals, businessmen, seethed in silence, plotting ways to reclaim their lost power. Foreign powers grew restless, alarmed by Traoré's open disdain for colonial arrangements. They watched warily as he expelled French forces, terminated military agreements that had kept the country shackled, and sought alliances on his own terms. The price of sovereignty, Traoré knew, would be steep, but he also knew something deeper. Freedom bought cheaply is no freedom at all. It must be earned and defended every day. Meanwhile, the people, the true soul of the nation, rallied behind him. Farmers donated sacks of millet to feed soldiers on the front. Teachers volunteered to reopen abandoned schools. Young men and women flocked to newly formed local defense groups, trading old fears for new pride. There were no illusions. Everyone understood that the road ahead would be bloody, uncertain, and long. But for the first time in decades, they believed it might actually lead somewhere. One evening, weeks after the coup, Ibrahim visited a small village near the northern front. The sun was sinking low, staining the sky with molten gold as he stepped out of his truck, surrounded by a few loyal guards. The village elder, a woman with silver hair and the straight-backed dignity of someone who had seen too much, approached him. She said nothing. Instead, she pressed something into his hand, a handful of earth, crumbled, dry, lifeless. But hers was not a gesture of despair. It was a charge, a reminder. "This is what we fight for," her gaze seemed to say. "This is who we are." Ibrahim bowed low before her, the dust clinging to his knees. He understood. He had not taken power to rule. He had taken it to serve, to heal, to build. As he left the village that night, driving under a sky ablaze with stars, Ibrahim allowed himself a rare moment of quiet hope. The road ahead was dangerous, the enemies unseen, the betrayals inevitable. But in that fleeting instant, with the warm breeze filling the truck's cabin and the scent of tilled earth in his lungs, Ibrahim Traoré believed, truly believed, that the soul of Burkina Faso could still be saved. And that, if necessary, he would give everything he had to save it, even his life. Chapter 7, shadows in the ranks. Victory, as Ibrahim Traoré quickly learned, was not the end of danger. In fact, it was merely the beginning. In the weeks after his takeover, as he toured devastated provinces and rallied a weary nation, something began to shift in the air. A tension, invisible but undeniable. A rustle in the leaves when no wind stirred. A second shadow where there should have been only one. At first, it was easy to dismiss. A misplaced document. A convoy delayed without reason. An uneasy glance exchanged between officers during late-night briefings. But Ibrahim had survived too many ambushes in the Sahel to ignore the feeling that now clawed at the back of his mind. Something was coming, and this time it would strike from within. The first clear sign came one humid evening in late October. Ibrahim was meeting with village elders in a reclaimed township near the northern front when one of his trusted bodyguards, a thick-necked sergeant named Adama, pulled him aside, face pale under the twilight sky. In his gloved hand, Adama held a small object, a ceramic coffee cup, harmless looking, except for the faint, unnatural sheen that coated its rim. A field test confirmed the worst. Poison. Someone with access to his most trusted inner circle, had tried to end him quietly, swiftly, without glory or spectacle. Just another dead man among many in a country already drowning in blood. The investigation was immediate, ruthless, and silent. No public announcements. No television statements. Ibrahim understood instinctively that if the people saw weakness, the fragile hope he had reignited could be snuffed out overnight. Instead, he summoned a handful of his most loyal officers to a hidden meeting in the basement of an abandoned ministry building, a place where cracked concrete walls still bore the scorch marks of past revolutions. There, in the flickering gloom of a single bare bulb, they pored over every security roster, every personnel file, every whispered report. The picture that emerged was chilling, a network of disillusioned officers, angry at Traoré's purges. Ex-officials with foreign contacts, desperate to restore the old order. Hired mercenaries lingering in the capital's shadows, their loyalties bought and sold like cheap cloth in the markets. The betrayal was not ideological. It was mercenary, pragmatic, cowardly, and it had rooted itself inside the very army Ibrahim had once thought invincible. A week later, the second attempt came. This time, it was not subtle. Ibrahim's convoy was returning from a morale inspection at a forward base when it happened. The road wound through a series of rocky hills, a known ambush point, but one they had cleared just days before. As the lead vehicle crested a rise, the ground erupted. A buried IED, triggered by remote detonator. The blast hurled the armored truck into the air like a child's toy, flipping it end over end before it slammed into the rocks in a shriek of metal and flame. Shrapnel shredded the windshield of Ibrahim's vehicle. The driver slumped sideways, blood blooming across his chest. Without thinking, Ibrahim seized the wheel, fighting the fishtailing wreckage as the convoy came under fire from the surrounding cliffs. Bullets pinged off the chassis. Mortar shells gouged craters into the dirt road. All around him, chaos. But chaos had been Ibrahim's tutor since his earliest days. He acted without hesitation. Deploy smoke. Suppress left flank. Move. Move. He wrenched open the side door, dragging the wounded driver to cover, barking orders as his men scrambled into defensive positions. The firefight raged for almost an hour, a brutal close-quarters engagement fought in the choking dust and smoke of the Sahel. When the last shots faded and the last enemy fled into the bush, leaving their dead behind, Ibrahim stood amidst the carnage, battered, bleeding from a shallow cut across his temple, but alive. And furious, not just at the attempt on his life, but at the violation of trust. Betrayal from within, the worst kind, the most dangerous kind. Interrogations followed. Swift. Unforgiving. Captured attackers revealed names. Faces. Ranks. Some of them, heartbreakingly, were men Ibrahim had once saluted. Men he had trusted to protect their homeland. Bribes had flowed from shadowy figures in foreign embassies, from wealthy businessmen who saw Traoré's anti-corruption crusade as a threat to their empires. The message had been clear. If you cannot buy him, break him. They had failed. But Ibrahim understood that the price of leadership in this new era was loneliness. Crushing, isolating loneliness. In the aftermath, Ibrahim delivered a single televised address. He stood before the battered national flag, no pomp, no ceremony. Just a soldier speaking plainly to his people. His voice was low, hard, and steady. There are those among us, he said, who fear change, who fear justice, who fear a Burkina Faso that cannot be bought. He let the words hang, heavy as thunderclouds. Let them know we will not be broken. We will not be silenced. We are the children of those who rose from the dust, and we will not return to it as slaves. Across the country, in homes lit by flickering lanterns and the glow of old radios, a chill ran through the people. But it was not fear. It was something harder, sharper, resolve. The enemies of change had revealed themselves. And Ibrahim Traoré, bloodied but unbowed, had declared the battle joined. That night, alone in his quarters, Ibrahim sat at a simple wooden desk. Before him lay a tattered journal, his father's old notebook, filled with aphorisms and scraps of history. He opened it to a blank page, picked up a battered pen, and wrote, "Victory is not winning the throne. Victory is remaining true to those who place their hopes in your hands." He underlined the words twice. Outside, in the darkness of the sleeping capital, new conspiracies were already stirring. But so too was something deeper, something that no bullet or bribe could kill. The will of a people who had finally found someone worth following. Someone worth fighting for. And Ibrahim Traoré was ready. Chapter 8, Between Empires and Allies. The world had tolerated a Captain Ibrahim Traoré when he was just a soldier fighting militants in forgotten villages. The world had even tolerated him staging a coup. After all, Africa had seen many. But when Ibrahim began speaking not just of reform, but of true independence, when he began making moves no puppet government would dare, the smiles in foreign embassies froze, and behind closed doors knives were drawn. It began with a letter, a formal diplomatic note, polite in tone but unmistakable in intent, delivered to the transitional government offices just weeks after Traoré's consolidation of power. From the French embassy, it advised caution. It recommended maintaining historical military agreements. It invited continued cooperation with French forces stationed in Burkina Faso. Under the veneer of diplomacy, the message was clear. Stay in line, play your role, or be abandoned. Ibrahim read it once, folded it carefully, set it aside, and never replied. Instead, he called a meeting, not with foreign dignitaries, but with his own people. Village chiefs, women's associations, union leaders, youth representatives. They gathered in a packed hall under the stifling heat of Ouagadougou's dry season, fanning themselves with scraps of paper, their eyes wary but curious. Ibrahim stood before them, no teleprompter, no scripted speech, and said simply, "Should Burkina Faso remain a prisoner to those who abandoned us?" A murmur rippled through the crowd. A merchant from the north, his hands still calloused from working the fields, rose to his feet. His voice cracked with age and emotion as he shouted, "No, not anymore." Others followed, first a few, then dozens, then hundreds, rising in a rolling wave of voices. "No, no more chains." The next morning, Ibrahim's government issued a stunning declaration. The French military presence in Burkina Faso was terminated immediately. The French ambassador was given 72 hours to leave. All agreements that compromised national sovereignty were under review. The capital erupted in chaotic celebration. Students marched through the streets waving Burkinabe flags. Vendors blared reggae music from battered radios. Old revolutionaries dusted off faded portraits of Thomas Sankara and wept openly in the sun. For the first time since the assassinated dreams of 1987, it felt as if Burkina Faso might finally, truly, be free. But freedom, Ibrahim knew, was a hungry beast. It demanded not just defiance, but sustenance. And Burkina Faso, bleeding, starving, and battered, needed new allies if it was to survive. The West, furious at the expulsion of France, began to quietly cut off aid. Sanctions loomed. Loans vanished. The fragile economy, already on life support, began to shudder under the weight of isolation. The old elites whispered that Traoré had doomed them all, that he was leading the country into darkness, that without foreign masters they would perish. But Ibrahim did not bend. Instead, he turned east, and to the Sahel itself. New meetings were held, discreet at first. Russian envoys appeared in the corridors of power, offering weapons, training, economic partnerships, no conditions attached. Meanwhile, Mali and Niger, fellow Sahelian nations under military leadership, sent delegations bearing proposals for a new regional alliance, a confederation of sovereign states, free from ECOWAS dictates, built to defend Sahelian interests with Sahelian hands. It was a dangerous game. The world branded it authoritarianism, destabilization, a drift toward dictatorship. But to the common people of Burkina Faso, the farmers, the herders, the teachers, the soldiers, it felt like something else. A chance to breathe, a chance to stand, a chance to finally decide their own fate. One pivotal night, Ibrahim sat across from a Russian general in a candlelit government chamber. The Russian, grizzled and shrewd, laid out maps and offers in clipped French. Security assistance, mining partnerships, technology transfers. At the end of the table, an old, cracked photograph sat propped against a bottle of water. A black and white portrait of a young Thomas Sankara smiling beside a battered bicycle. Ibrahim glanced at the photograph, then at the maps, then back at the general. His voice, when it came, was ice-edged. "We will not trade one master for another. Burkina Faso will walk on its own legs, or not at all." The Russian hesitated, then surprisingly smiled, and nodded. No contracts were signed that night, only understandings clear, hard, and sober. Burkina Faso would not become anyone's pawn. Not again. Meanwhile, in the villages and streets, the people watched with bated breath. Radio broadcasts replayed Ibrahim's speeches again and again. "We are not against cooperation. We are against domination. Our resources are ours. Our future is ours. Our dignity is not for sale." It became a mantra, repeated in marketplaces, whispered over cooking fires, sung by schoolchildren. And slowly, agonizingly slowly, the contours of a new Burkina Faso began to take shape. Local industries revived under national management. Gold mines seized back from foreign corporations. Agricultural projects launched to feed the hungry without foreign imports. Militias armed and trained to defend their own villages without waiting for distant armies to care. It was messy. It was painful. It was slow. But it was theirs. Foreign newspapers painted Traoré as a populist, a dangerous nationalist, a threat to regional stability. They called him arrogant, unpredictable, foolhardy. But inside Burkina Faso, among the women tending new gardens and the boys repairing abandoned schools, he was something else entirely. He was a lion. A lion who had refused the leash. A lion who had chosen the hard road, the lonely road, the righteous road. The people, battered, bloodied, weary though they were, stood a little taller because of it. One evening, as he walked alone along the mossy plateau, the sun setting fire to the vast horizon, Ibrahim stopped and looked out over the land he had sworn to serve. The wind stirred the dust at his feet. Far below, he could hear the distant hum of life. Hammers striking new homes, children laughing, women singing work songs older than memory. He thought of the choices he had made, the friends he had lost, the enemies he had made. And he knew, with a clarity that cut through the weariness and fear, he would rather stand alone in honor than kneel with the world in disgrace. The night deepened. The stars burned cold and bright. And Captain Ibrahim Traoré, son of farmers, child of Bondiqui, soldier of the soil, walked on into the gathering dark. Unbent. Unbroken. Unafraid. Chapter 9, The Coup Unmasked. It began, as betrayals often do, with a whisper. A casual comment passed between two junior officers over a late-night drink. A strange radio transmission caught by a communications post near the outskirts of the capital. A rumor, slippery as smoke, sliding through the barracks. Something is coming. Something big. At first, Ibrahim dismissed the warnings. Paranoia was the poison that had felled better men than him. And Burkina Faso needed a steady hand, not a twitching one. But then came the reports, credible, precise, chilling. Multiple senior officers, some with old ties to the overthrown elites, were plotting a counter-coup. The plan was bold, audacious. Seize key military bases. Assassinate loyalist commanders. Overwhelm the capital with rapid strikes before dawn. Capture or kill Ibrahim Traoré before he could rally the people. The date was set, September 26, 2023. The knives were already drawn. And this time there would be no mercy. The night before the planned coup, the capital of Ouagadougou throbbed with a false calm. The markets bustled. Children played soccer in the dusty streets. Vendors hawked fried dough and spicy stew from battered carts. But beneath the surface, a second city stirred, a city of conspirators, mercenaries, and traitors tightening their nets. Traoré moved through it like a man walking across thin ice. He met quietly with his most trusted commanders in a small, windowless war room deep within the presidential compound. The air was thick with tension. Maps and diagrams littered the battered oak table. "We do not act rashly," Ibrahim said, his voice low and hard. "We do not become what we fight. But we will not let the future be stolen from our people by cowards in the dark." His men nodded grimly. The trap was set. They would not run. They would not hide. They would stand and fight. At 2:43 a.m., the first shots rang out. The conspirators struck a communications base on the city's eastern edge, overwhelming the night shift guards with brutal efficiency. Simultaneously, a rogue armored unit rolled toward the presidential compound, its turrets sweeping the silent streets. But Troria's forces were ready. As the rogue column neared the palace gates, concealed loyalist forces ambushed them, anti-tank missiles screaming from hidden positions, ripping into the lead vehicles. The sky erupted in fire and chaos. Gunfire shattered windows. Sirens wailed. The air itself seemed to tremble with violence. And through it all, Ibrahim Traoré remained at the heart of the storm, moving between units, issuing calm, sharp orders, refusing to flinch even as bullets tore the night apart. This was not new. This was battle. And battle had always been his element. Across the city, the conspirators faltered. Their surprise advantage evaporated under the withering counterassault. Outposts they expected to seize without a fight turned into bloody bottlenecks. Barracks they thought were sympathetic raised Troria's flag instead, rallying loyalists. The people, awakened by the gunfire, flooded into the streets, not in fear but in defiance. They formed human barricades. They threw stones at rebel convoys. They linked arms and sang old songs of resistance from the time of Sankara. The conspirators had miscalculated. They thought they were fighting a man. They realized, too late, they were fighting a nation. By dawn, it was over. The surviving plotters were rounded up, some in handcuffs, others bleeding, all with the haunted look of men who had gambled and lost everything. Traoré stood on the steps of the National Assembly as the first golden rays of sunlight spilled across the battered city. Before him gathered a sea of faces, soldiers, civilians, children perched on shoulders, elders clutching canes, all looking to him. He had no prepared speech, no grand pronouncements, only the raw, exhausted truth. "They tried to break us," he said, voice cracking with emotion. "But Burkina Faso belongs to its people. Not to traitors. Not to foreign masters. Not to fear." A roar of approval surged through the crowd, powerful enough to shake the flagpoles above them. "We will build this nation with our hands," he continued, his fist raised high, "or we will die trying. But we will never kneel again." The chant rose, deafening and unstoppable. "Traoré! Traoré! Traoré!" In the hours that followed, as the wounded were tended and the wreckage cleared, Ibrahim found a moment of quiet. He stood alone at the edge of the mossy plateau once again, the city sprawling behind him like a wounded beast struggling to heal. The morning breeze stirred the dust at his feet. The scent of smoke and sweat and hope hung heavy in the air. He closed his eyes. He thought of the children who would wake tomorrow under a sky not owned by foreign drones. He thought of the farmers who would plant their fields without paying bribes to distant masters. He thought of the blood that had been spilled, and the duty that remained. And he understood, more clearly than ever before. Freedom is not a moment. It is a war fought every day. A war of hearts, of wills, of dreams. And he was willing to fight it. For as long as it took. For as long as he breathed. Chapter 10, Voices of the Land. History, it is often said, is written by leaders. But the soul of a nation, its laughter, its grief, its stubborn hope, is etched in the everyday voices of its people. And in the months that followed the failed coup, the broken streets of Burkina Faso began to buzz with those voices, rising like green shoots after a long, brutal drought. Not in grand speeches, but in small, stubborn acts of life. In the northern province of Somme, where jihadist raids had once made planting crops a death sentence, a grizzled farmer named Mohamedou bent low over a field of newly sprouted millet. His back ached. His hands were gnarled and scarred. But his eyes gleamed with something fierce as he spoke to a visiting journalist. "Before," he said, "we hid. We waited for the soldiers who never came. Now," he straightened slowly, his face cracked into a smile as wide and rough as the plains around him. "Now we have our sons in uniform. We have our own rifles. We have Traoré and ourselves." He pressed a handful of rich, black earth into the journalist's palm. "Tell them. Tell the world. We are not afraid anymore." In a battered schoolhouse outside Kaya, where bullet holes still pocked the crumbling walls, a young teacher named Aminata unlocked the doors for the first time in nearly 2 years. The classroom smelled of dust and old sorrow. But she lit the oil lamp anyway. She wiped the chalkboard clean anyway. She waited. And as the sun climbed over the ruins of the village, they came. A trickle at first, then a flood, barefoot children in torn clothes, clutching battered notebooks like treasures. Aminata wept openly as she called roll. And when she finished, she stood before them, voice shaking but proud, and wrote a single word across the board in great looping letters. Future. Future. They would have one now. on the battered southern front near Puh, where landmines still lay hidden beneath the earth like angry ghosts. Captain Issouf Diallo, a young officer once trained under Ibrahim himself, spoke to his platoon. His face was weathered beyond his years. The lines around his mouth spoke of too many funerals, too many broken promises. But when he spoke of his commander, his voice burned with pride. "Traoré fights where we fight, sleeps where we sleep, eats what we eat." He lifted his rifle skyward. "Under him, we do not die for lies. We die for each other." The men around him, young and old, farmers and mechanics turned soldiers, slammed their boots into the dirt in silent, iron-hard agreement. In the crowded markets of Ouagadougou, merchants who once cowered during strikes and protests now haggled loudly again over yams, over woven cloth, over used radios. Life, chaotic and stubborn, surged back into the bones of the city. A grandmother named Salim Atta, her head wrapped in vibrant wax cloth, chuckled as she traded 3 onions for a packet of rice. "We buried too many sons," she said, arranging her goods with careful hands. "But maybe we will not bury hope." She glanced toward a nearby wall where someone had painted a rough mural. Ibrahim Traoré, drawn not as a general, but as a farmer sowing seeds into the cracked earth. Beneath it, a slogan in dripping black paint: "From our blood, a harvest of freedom." In the shadows of old colonial government buildings, young artists, poets, and musicians reclaimed the public squares with their drums and brushes. Songs rose into the dusty twilight. Not songs of despair, but songs of defiance and rebirth. One of them, a wiry teenager with bright eyes named Yusuf, slammed his gem drum and sang. "They said we were weak. We answered with stone. They said we were broken. We answered with song. They said we had no future. We answered with Traoré." Passersby clapped and danced. Even the tired vendors smiled. Even the old men nodded. For the first time in a generation, it felt as if Burkina Faso was not merely surviving. It was alive. But not all voices sang. There were still murmurs of doubt, quiet worries in the tea shops, grim discussions in the dark corners of cafes. Would Traoré cling to power too long? Could he survive the next assassination attempt, the next economic sabotage, the next betrayal? No one knew. And Ibrahim himself did not pretend otherwise. He did not offer promises of easy miracles. Only the hard, bitter truth. "The road will be long. The road will be dangerous. But we walk it together. Or we die apart." And for now, for today, the people chose to walk it with him. In the late evenings, as the last rays of sun fled across the savannah, Ibrahim often sat on the roof of the presidential residence, a modest building stripped of its old French furnishings and golden ornaments. He would sit cross-legged, listening to the city breathe, the murmur of marketplaces, the cries of children playing soccer in the alleys, the low rumble of soldiers singing around distant campfires. And in those moments, he felt it, not power, not glory, but something deeper, the weight of a nation's dreams, the fragile, holy trust placed in his hands. He knew he would fail sometimes. He knew he would bleed again. But he also knew, with every fiber of his battered body, that he would not betray them. Not for gold. Not for fear. Not for anything. Burkina Faso had spoken. And its voice, bruised, battered, stubborn, beautiful, was no longer a whisper. It was a roar. And Ibrahim Traoré stood at its center, not as a king, but as its servant, its son, its hope. Chapter 11, Conspirators Unmasked. By late 2024, the victories had stacked high, and so had the enemies. Burkina Faso was no longer a forgotten name muttered by foreign diplomats. It had become a symbol of rebellion, of resistance, of a small nation refusing to bow. And to the old powers, the ones who had long fattened themselves on African chaos, symbols could be far more dangerous than armies. The warning came on a crisp morning in December. Traoré was reviewing infrastructure plans for a new railway project, one meant to connect landlocked Burkina Faso to the Atlantic coast without foreign control. When his chief intelligence officer, Colonel Abdoulaye Sanfo, burst into the office without knocking, his face was ashen. Without a word, he laid a dossier on the desk. Photos, interrogation transcripts, wiretap recordings. Piece by piece, the story unfolded. A network of disillusioned officers inside the security services. Several prominent businessmen whose fortunes had withered under Traoré's reforms. Foreign mercenaries, paid in gold, not promises, smuggled across the porous borders. Their plan was chillingly bold. Traoré's convoy, scheduled to visit a reforestation project outside Bobo-Dioulasso, would be ambushed. A planted car bomb, buried deep beneath the road, would trigger when his lead vehicle passed. Snipers, concealed in the trees, would finish off any survivors. Within minutes, the transition government would collapse into chaos. A coup in all but name. Brutal. Efficient. Final. For a long moment, Ibrahim said nothing. He simply stared at the photographs. Faces he knew. Men he had once saluted. Men who had once claimed to fight for the same soil. Betrayal burned worse than any bullet wound. But there was no time for anger. Only action. Swift. Precise. Relentless. Under a veil of secrecy, a counteroperation was launched. Surveillance teams tracked the conspirators. Safe houses were raided in the dead of night. Hidden arms caches were seized before they could be activated. One by one, the plotters fell. Dragged from their hiding places in the early hours, blinking against the harsh light, cursing and pleading. But two key players remained hidden. The foreign operatives, ruthless, well-trained, and still at large. And the bomb meant for Traoré, was already in place. The convoy rolled out at dawn as scheduled. Ibrahim insisted on going forward with the trip. His advisors begged him to cancel. To stay hidden. To show caution. But Traoré, true to the blood that had carried him through so many battlefields, refused. "If I hide," he said simply, "they win without firing a shot." So he went. Not armored inside a bulletproof cocoon. But in the open. In the lead vehicle. Daring them. Daring fate itself. As the convoy approached the danger zone, a dusty stretch of road lined with skeletal trees. The trap was sprung. A black SUV parked innocently at the roadside exploded without warning, hurling a shockwave of fire and shrapnel into the air. The convoy swerved wildly. Gunfire erupted from the treeline, sharp, professional bursts. But this time, Traoré's loyalists were ready. They had anticipated every move. Elite snipers hidden in advanced positions took out the attackers with merciless precision. Mortar teams shelled the escape routes. Within minutes, the would-be assassins lay dead or captured, their bodies sprawled across the smoking wreckage of their failure. And Ibrahim Traoré, still standing amidst the swirling dust, still alive, still unbowed, raised his fist to the sky. The convoy rolled on, battered but unbroken. That evening, Traoré addressed the nation. He did not do it from behind layers of security. He stood in the open, in the heart of the capital, surrounded by thousands who had poured into the streets to show their defiance. His voice thundered through the night. "They tried to kill me. They tried to kill Burkina Faso. But we are not so easy to kill." The crowd erupted, a rolling, thunderous wave of sound that echoed off the crumbling colonial facades, off the battered marketplaces, off the dreams of a people reborn. "They do not fear my life," Traoré said, his eyes sweeping the sea of faces. "They fear your courage. They fear your freedom. They fear that a small nation can rise without asking permission." He lifted his hand, battered and scarred but steady. "Let them fear. We will not bow. We will not break. And if they come again, they will find not just one man standing. They will find an entire nation. A million hearts beating as one." The chants began again. "Traoré! Traoré! Traoré!" But this time it was different. It was not worship. It was something deeper. Something holy. A covenant. In the days that followed, the surviving conspirators were tried in public courts. There were no secret executions. No disappearances in the night. Only justice, swift, visible, and fair. Because Ibrahim understood. If Burkina Faso was to live, it had to be better than its enemies. It had to be better than its past. In the quiet hours afterward, Ibrahim sat alone in the courtyard of the old presidential palace, gazing up at the stars. The wounds were deep, physical, emotional, spiritual. But so too was the resolve. He thought of his parents, their calloused hands planting crops in the harsh soil. He thought of the children learning once again under crumbling roofs. He thought of the blood spilled, and the lives saved. And he whispered into the warm, dusty night, "I am not alone. They walk with me. The living. The dead. The unborn." And with that simple prayer, he rose, straightened his uniform, and prepared to walk forward once more. Into history. Into destiny. Into the fierce, unbroken future of Burkina Faso. Chapter 12. The Dream of Tomorrow. When the dust of battle settles. When the last conspirator is unmasked. When the last bullet is fired. When the last betrayal is forgiven or forgotten. What remains? For Captain Ibrahim Traoré, the answer was clear. The future. Not just survival. Not just slogans. A true, living, breathing future. Built by the hands of the people. Fueled by their dreams. Protected by their sacrifice. And he was determined, with every scar on his body, every drop of blood spilled, every moment of stolen sleep, to help bring it into being. The blueprint for Burkina Faso's rebirth was drawn not in secret meetings or foreign boardrooms, but in the open air, under the unforgiving Sahel sun, amidst the dusty fields and crowded markets where real life pulsed and strained to endure. It would be a future built on five unshakable pillars. 1. Security rooted in the people. The first and most urgent need. Peace. Not the fragile, bought peace of foreign military bases, but the hard-won peace of communities defending themselves. Local militias, volunteers for the defense of the homeland, were expanded, trained, and equipped, not to become warlords, but to become guardians. Elders, youths, women, all given a stake, a voice, a rifle if necessary, to defend the soil they called home. Village by village, road by road, Burkina Faso pushed back the darkness. No invader would ever again be able to claim her lands without a fight. 2. Self-reliant economy. Under Traoré's bold vision, Burkina Faso would no longer export its gold and cotton for pennies, only to import back overpriced goods. Instead, a national gold refinery was built, capable of processing 150 tons per year, ensuring that the nation, not foreign corporations, controlled its own wealth. Agricultural programs exploded across the countryside, empowering farmers to grow for local markets, not for foreign supermarkets. A $250 million international dry port and airport project near Ouagadougou was launched, finally offering Burkina Faso a lifeline to the Atlantic free from exploitative tolls. Every franc of profit stayed home. Every seed planted stayed rooted. Every hand that worked was honored. 3. Education without chains. Traoré knew. A free nation cannot live if its people remain trapped in ignorance. He poured resources into reopening schools once shuttered by war. He slashed bureaucratic barriers that had made education a privilege instead of a right. He ordered new curricula, rooted not in colonial shame, but in African pride, innovation, and self-respect. In the rebuilt classrooms, children once again scrawled their dreams on battered slates. They learned of Sankara, of Mandela, of Nzinga, of the ancestors who had fought for the soil beneath their feet. And they learned of themselves, their worth, their power, their future. 4. Healthcare for all. Hospitals, once hollowed out by corruption and neglect, began to hum with life. Mobile clinics fanned out into rural areas. Doctors and nurses were paid living wages. Stockpiles of medicines, once pilfered and sold on black markets, were secured and distributed. No Burkinabe would die of a curable disease while elites jetted off to Paris for treatment. Not under Traoré's watch. Not ever again. 5. Cultural renaissance. Perhaps most revolutionary of all, Ibrahim Traoré understood that true independence is not just about guns and money. It is about spirit, about identity. He launched initiatives to revive traditional arts, music, storytelling. He celebrated the old kingdoms, the warrior queens, the griots who had kept history alive in whispered songs. He commissioned monuments to the forgotten martyrs of resistance, not sterile statues of bureaucrats, but living gardens, murals, festivals where the soul of Burkina Faso could bloom in full color. A people without memory is a people easily conquered. Traoré vowed, Burkina Faso would remember, and because it remembered, it would endure. Of course, the road remained perilous. Every victory bred new enemies. Every step forward came at a cost. There were still bombs, still betrayals, still dark money flowing into shadowy hands. But the center held, because the people, the real power, had tasted a different future. And once tasted, it could not be forgotten. On the second anniversary of his leadership, Ibrahim Traoré stood once again before his people. The Grand Parade Ground in Ouagadougou, once reserved for foreign dignitaries and corrupt generals, now thronged with farmers, teachers, students, builders, soldiers. Men and women who had rebuilt their villages, who had defended their borders, who had planted the seeds of a new nation with their own blood and sweat. He spoke without a script, without a teleprompter. His voice was hoarse from exhaustion, his uniform stained from days on the road. But his eyes blazed brighter than ever. I did not save you, he said simply. You saved yourselves. A hush fell. I am only your servant, your brother, your son, and I will walk with you into whatever storms may come until my last breath. The applause that followed was not the applause of subjects for a king. It was the applause of a family, a people who had found their voice, their dignity, their future, together. And so, as the sun dipped low over the Sahel, casting long golden shadows across a land scarred but unbroken. Captain Ibrahim Traoré, son of Bondiqui, son of struggle, son of hope, smiled quietly to himself. There would be more battles. There would be more blood. But there would also be a tomorrow. A tomorrow forged not by foreign masters, not by distant empires, but by the calloused, stubborn, beautiful hands of Burkina Faso's own sons and daughters. And in that tomorrow, they would stand free, whatever the cost, whatever it took, forever.